Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service, bringing you extraordinary personal stories from around the globe. Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 21st of September, these are our main stories. The president of Azerbaijan says his forces have restored the country's sovereignty over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. America's central bank has left interest rates unchanged, but has dampened hopes of a rapid fall in inflation. And Venezuelan troops have seized the country's largest prison, which had been controlled for years by a powerful criminal gang. Also in this podcast, guess what you can get away with as a new baby name in Australia.
My jaw hit the floor when I saw the birth certificate.
We're going to start in the Caucasus, where a hastily agreed ceasefire between Azerbaijan and ethnic Armenians in the breakaway enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh appears to be holding. In an address to the nation, the Azerbaijani president, Ilham Aliyev, hailed the success of his military's offensive, saying sovereignty had been restored. He also insisted that he had nothing against the ethnic Armenian population.
I've said the Armenian population living in Azerbaijan are our citizens. To put it simply, Armenian nationalists, war criminals, leaders of Armenia and Karabakh took these people hostage, poisoned their brains. Despite all the injustices and all the crimes committed by the criminal Armenian regime, we have never blamed the Armenian people.
Well, during the 24-hour offensive, Azerbaijani forces attacked the region with artillery fire, missiles and drones. A human rights official said as many as 200 people had been killed and many more injured, although the BBC hasn't been able to verify those figures independently. Around 100,000 ethnic Armenians live in the enclave and their future is now in doubt, with talk of reintegration. Our Caucasus correspondent, Rehan Dimitri, is following developments, and she began by telling me more about that TV address.
He said that all their plans on reintegration of ethnic Armenians will be laid out at a meeting in Azerbaijani city, to which the Karabakh Armenians have agreed. It was part of the ceasefire agreement that was signed earlier today and mediated by Russia. And President Aliyev kind of finished his speech with kind of shaking his fist and saying, Karabakh is Azerbaijan and we will show them. We have shown it to everybody. It's our sovereign territory. So very much kind of marking the victory, because what Azerbaijan launched yesterday, what it described as anti-terror operation, it really kind of marks the final push by Azerbaijan to regain control of all the territories that it lost in the 1990s.
And just quickly on that ceasefire, I mean, is it holding tonight? And secondly, who will police it? Who will ensure that it holds?
It appears to be holding, but there's so much uncertainty. We've seen pictures of thousands of people gathering at the airport in the regional capital, Stepanakert. The airport never, ever functioned because of the airspace was blocked by Azerbaijan. But the situation looks quite desperate for ethnic Armenians. And it looks like many of them want to leave the region, but they don't know how.
Rehan Dimitri with her assessment. So, what now is the future for the 100,000 ethnic Armenians living in the enclave? Before the Azerbaijani president made his victory speech, Rebecca Kesby spoke to David Babayan, an advisor to the leadership of Nagorno-Karabakh, which is known locally as the Artsakh Republic. He gave her his understanding of the current situation.
The battles stopped, but the struggle continues, because we have to adopt a very harsh historical decisions about our future.
You say the struggle continues. Have you dissolved the ethnic Armenian administration to which you belong? I mean, that was one of the key demands of the Azeris, wasn't it?
Yes, it's their basic goal, but we have just to meet with them and discuss different issues. The general mood of our population is that if there is no other possibility I mean, if everybody actually renounce any help of Artsakh, Republic of Armenia, Russia, the civilized community, they are all accepting that we should be part of Azerbaijan, then it's much better just to leave, to organize a kind of exodus of population, a biblical exodus, because this is what our population, what our people think. This is why when I am talking about historical period and very harsh decisions, I mean exactly this way.
So at the moment, your administration hasn't decided whether you will dissolve or not until you speak directly to the Azeris. What are your immediate plans then? You're going to stay in Stepanakert?
Well, first of all, we have to meet and discuss different issues. But anyway, our population and our people actually, they, because we are also a democratic state and we cannot ignore the will of people who are the sovereigns of democratic states, basically. So we have to take into consideration their basic needs and their vision. And within that case, I think that we have to adopt indeed a crucial historical decisions which will actually shape the destiny of not only Artsakh Armenians, but also the Armenian people in general. And also it will bring to a drastic reformating of the geopolitical landscape in Transcaucasus.
Are you talking about doing some sort of deal whereby your administration could stay in place? What kind of assurances would you be looking for?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that these negotiations should also touch upon not only political issues, but we also have humanitarian issues. We have, for example, could have some bodies of perished soldiers on both sides. We will have the issue of electricity supply, humanitarian issues, because Artsakh has been under siege and blockade for more than 9 months. So we have a lot of issues to discuss.
David Babian, an advisor to the leadership of Nagorno-Karabakh. Now let's go to New York, where both Ukraine and Russia addressed the UN Security Council on Wednesday as President Zelensky condemned Moscow's invasion of his country as criminal. Ukraine's leader, who is at the annual gathering in the city in person for the first time since his country was invaded last year, said Russia must be stripped of its power of veto on the Security Council. President Zelensky said there should instead be a two-thirds majority to take decisions, as Russia's veto had made any action to stop the war impossible.
Russia will not give up this stolen privilege voluntarily. Therefore, the UN General Assembly should be given a real power to overcome the veto. This will be the first necessary step. If it is impossible to stop the war because all efforts are vetoed by the aggressor.
Our correspondent Neda Torfik is in New York and she listened to the president's speech.
This was, as you said, the first time he was there. And keep in mind that the council has met dozens of times on Ukraine, but there has never been action because of Russia's veto. So that's why he focused so much of his comments on that issue. But, you know, he also spoke about the fact that people have stopped pinning their hopes on the UN. He says Ukrainian soldiers are now doing at the expense of their blood what the UN Security Council should do by its vote, that they are the ones upholding the principles of the UN Charter. And so he really tried to push for nations there who haven't outright condemned Russia to say that by arming Ukraine, by supporting sanctions, it means that they were defending not just Ukraine, but the entire globe, the UN Charter again. So these were kind of his lobbying efforts here in the council. I think more broadly, he is just pushing for reform of the UN system because that's very popular right now here with other nations. And he's using the war in Ukraine as another push to put UN reform on the agenda.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov also addressed the Security Council. I'm not sure if the two men were actually in the same room at the same time. But what did Mr. Lavrov have to say?
It was a bit of a diplomatic dance there. We were waiting to see if there would be any fiery rhetoric between the two. They actually made sure they weren't in the room together. I think the one little bit of drama was that Russia's ambassador to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, tried to have President Zelensky ejected from the meeting altogether. But then Albania's prime minister said that they would agree to stop the meeting if Russia stopped the war. Now, as far as what the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, said when he did come into the room and President Zelensky left, well, he accused the West of really creating these global tensions. He said since the fall of the Soviet Union, The United States and its allies had been meddling in Ukraine, trying to bring them over to the West. That ahead of their full-scale invasion, although they call it a special military operation, he said NATO refused to engage in dialogue to really speak with Russia about their security concerns. And so he defended Russia's invasion and he defended the use of the veto, saying it's a legitimate tool that others at the UN use.
Neda Torfik reporting. Just going to stay in the US, where America's central bank has kept its key interest rate unchanged. But it's forecast another rise by the end of this year to help tackle inflation. The US Federal Reserve said it still had a long way to go in lowering inflation sustainably. Michelle Fleury is in New York.
The US Federal Reserve left interest rates steady between 5.25% and 5.5%, but indicated its fight against inflation isn't over. Officials at America's central bank signalled that they are prepared to hike one more time this year and hold rates higher for longer. Central bankers now project higher growth and lower unemployment for next year. If they're right, the US will have avoided a long-feared recession. The Fed began lifting interest rates from near zero in March 2022.
Here in the UK, the Prime Minister has announced a major shift in the country's pace of cutting carbon emissions. With a general election expected next year, Rishi Sunak said he was softening policies that would phase out buying new diesel cars by 2030 or force people to replace their domestic gas boilers. Mr. Sunak insisted, though, that the world's sixth largest economy will still aim to hit its target of net zero emissions by 2050. It was only 2 years ago that the government, under a different prime minister, championed a so-called green industrial revolution. This was Rishi Sunak in Downing Street explaining his about turn.
The debate about how we get to net zero has thrown up a range of worrying proposals. And today I want to confirm that under this government, they will never happen. The proposal to make you change your diet and harm British farmers by taxing meat, or to create new taxes to discourage flying or going on holiday. I've scrapped those too. And nor will we ban new oil and gas in the North Sea, which would simply leave us reliant on expensive imported energy from foreign dictators like Putin.
Well, I sat down with our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, to get his assessment of Wednesday's announcements.
There certainly were tweaks to some of the targets that the government has made, you know, some of them more significant than others. He says he's going to stick by the 2050 net zero target and the really ambitious target for cutting emissions by 2030, 68% target by 2030. He says he hopes to achieve that. What struck me was, I mean, there was a big change in terms of the cars. You know, getting rid of the 2030 target is quite a big deal and is a, you know, is likely to slow consumer take up of a technology. I was slightly confounded by that. I was quite surprised by it because actually sales of electric vehicles in Britain are outperforming the expectations both of the industry and of the Climate Change Committee and of the government. So we're doing quite well. And he kind of acknowledged that in the speech and said, you know, like the technology is becoming increasingly persuasive and we expect people will take up those cars of their own choice. We're just not going to force you. Well, we heard howls of complaint from the car industry when it was rumoured that he was going to do this. They said, look, we want certainty. It helps us if we have a ban because we're investing hundreds of millions of pounds on changing, retooling our factories to make electric vehicles, and we want to be certain there's a market in the future.
There's always an interplay, isn't there, of international commitments and domestic politics for any politician elected in a democratic system. Do you think this announcement today is going to affect perceptions in those key capitals, Beijing and Delhi, when Rishi Sunak sits down opposite those leaders and they say, well, look, on the one hand, you're saying this, pressuring us, but on the other hand, you're announcing this?
Boris Johnson says the UK is a leader in cutting carbon. It certainly has been. You know, we've cut carbon by almost 50% on 1990 levels by last year. That exceeded the kind of carbon cuts achieved by other countries, which is what the Prime Minister said. That does give you a certain amount of diplomatic heft when you sit down and try and persuade other countries to change their behaviour. It certainly weakens them. I do wonder, I mean, I'm not sure how much India and China kind of would be persuaded by the effort of Britain to change their behaviour. But smaller countries, you know, we did have influence. And I suspect that this will kind of make it a little bit less persuasive that, you know, for example, and obviously the commitment to oil and gas in the North Sea, you know, we're saying to some African countries, please don't develop your oil reserves. They're much poorer than us. They've haven't had the benefits of a long industrial revolution. And obviously, you know, it makes it even harder. I mean, it's a tough argument anyway, makes it even harder if we're sucking out the last bits of oil and gas from our reserves. So I think, yeah, it does make it trickier in international negotiations, does kind of weaken Britain's Britain's, if you like, moral authority.
The BBC's climate editor, Justin Rowlatt. Archaeologists say their discovery of a wooden structure that's almost 500,000 years old could change our understanding of early human life. Ancient logs that are carved and overlapping were unearthed from the banks of a river in Zambia. The research by teams from Liverpool and Aberystwyth universities here in the UK, published in the journal Nature, suggest Stone Age people built what may have been shelters. Here's our science correspondent, Victoria Gill.
Prehistoric wooden artefacts are rare because wood rots away. But at this site, pieces of wood were trapped in a riverbed, waterlogged and essentially pickled for millennia. Archaeologists found tools, including wedges and tapered digging sticks, but most significant were two large logs laid out at right angles to each other, as Professor Jeff Duller from the University of Aberystwyth explains.
One's lying over the other, and both pieces of wood have had notches cut into them. And you can clearly see those notches have been cut by stone tools, and it makes the two logs fit together and allows these to become structural objects. And that's really exciting to think that at this time people were building structures.
Dating layers of sediment grains the wood was buried in revealed that the timber was about 476,000 years old. The smaller log is a metre and a half long, so the structure these ancient people were building is likely to have been substantial, perhaps a platform or a shelter. The researchers didn't find bones at the site, so they don't know what species of early human made the structure. These logs are much older than the earliest modern human or Homo sapien fossils, but Professor Duller says that doesn't rule out our own species.
It's possible it is Homo sapiens, and we just haven't discovered fossils from that age. But equally, it could be Homo erectus, Homo naledi. There were a number of hominin species at that time in southern Africa.
The wood was brought to the UK for analysis and preservation. It's stored in tanks that mimic the waterlogging that preserved it so beautifully for 500,000 years. But it'll soon be returned to a museum collection in Zambia to go on display.
Victoria Gill reporting. Well, still to come.
Guinea pigs, that's all they were. The British government turned around to you and say, you prove it.
Veterans who took part in British nuclear weapons tests in the 1950s and 60s are attempting to relaunch a battle for compensation.
Our planet's climate is changing.
We are in the midst of a climate crisis.
The climate question speaks to those hit the hardest.
The problems caused by deforestation and the environment are huge. We are in big trouble.
And asks what we can do to soften the impact for the future.
We do have the means to do something about this.
Try and reduce our reliance on fossil fuels.
Way more wind and solar.
I do have a lot of faith for the future.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Now, a massive security operation has taken place in Venezuela to seize back control of one of the country's most notorious prisons. More than 11,000 soldiers and police officers were involved, targeting gangs in the Tocoron prison in the northern state of Aragua. The authorities say they are now in control. I heard more about the security operation from our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
The government says it was a resounding success that they've managed to take control of the compound after several hours. There was footage online and some footage released by the government showing flames inside, but there is no information of casualties. Apparently what happened is the gang leaders that control this compound, is a quite powerful gang in Venezuela, they escaped when they saw them coming. So it's 11,000 soldiers and police involved in the operation. The government described that as phase one of the operation, regain control, transferring all the 6,000 inmates to other facilities. And phase two will be to go after these gang leaders and to arrest them.
Just to clarify, so some of these gang leaders have managed to escape from the prison itself, or do you mean within the prison?
From the prison, because that prison was basically, from what the accounts that people had in Venezuela, is that people just came in and out as they wanted. For example, many of the prisoners lived with their families there, with their wives and children inside the prison. It's a surreal scenario. They had this prison had a swimming pool, nightclub, gambling areas and all sorts of facilities in there. And what happens is the gangs took over control. They charged protection money, basically extorting all prisoners. and they provided the services. Basically, the state left abandoned the prison, and it happened in many other prisons across Venezuela. So when they saw that the operation was coming in force and thousands of people were coming to break into the prison, they just left, they escaped.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the prisoners themselves and how bad, frankly, some of these people really are in terms of Venezuela's gang culture and how influential they are in the country.
Well, there is interesting links between the gangs and politicians. Many recordings of groups inside prisons chanting political songs and supporting this or that candidate. It's a very strange mix. This gang is quite powerful. It's known as Aragua Train, and they operate across Venezuela with racketeering, prostitution, illegal gold mining, and it was all controlled from inside the prisons. All prisons in Venezuela are in an awful state and overcrowded. The government has been talking about prison reform for a long time, but it hasn't happened.
Leonardo Rocha. Next to Myanmar, where at least 30 people have died and dozens are missing after a military cargo boat sank in the north of the country. The Chinwind River, where the boat capsized, has become a critical transport route since the 2021 coup, but monsoon rains have made it treacherous. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head reports.
The boat was in a convoy of 11 vessels, which local people say had been regularly moving along this part of the Chinwind River to supply military posts further north. It had just taken on more passengers when it was caught in a powerful eddy in the rain-swollen river and capsized. Eyewitnesses say they believe there were around 100 people on board, including soldiers and teachers and students from pro-military communities who wanted to reach the city of Monewa. The Chinwin has always been an important transport route in this region, but since the civil war ignited by the coup in 2021, it's become a vital supply line for the military, as road convoys are often ambushed or mined by insurgents from the People's Defence Forces or PDFs. The river convoys are frequently fired upon, but in this case, PDF sources have told the BBC that there was no shooting before the accident. This is the peak of the monsoon rain season in Myanmar, when river currents are at their strongest and most difficult to navigate.
Jonathan Head reporting. Here in the UK, veterans who took part in the country's nuclear weapons tests in the 1950s and 60s are attempting to relaunch a battle for compensation a decade after being legally blocked from suing the government. Campaigners say newly discovered documents suggest that military officers may have had suspicions that personnel suffered radioactive damage. More than 22,000 military staff worked on detonations in Australia and the South Pacific. Here's our Home Affairs correspondent, Dominic Cassiani.
For decades, personnel who witnessed the nuclear bomb tests in the 1950s and 60s have believed that later illnesses, including cancer and birth defects in their children, could be blamed on radiation damage. There were virtually no safety precautions on the ground. Some planes even flew through the mushroom clouds. Judges told the men in 2012 they had run out of time to sue, but recently discovered documents have convinced campaigners they have another chance. The file suggests military chiefs kept blood and urine records in secret archives, tracking the health of the bomb test witnesses. Eric Barton and other members of the campaign are determined to go back to court. Now aged 82, he witnessed six nuclear bomb tests and is appalled at how he and his comrades have been treated.
Guinea pigs, that's all they were. The British government turned around to you and say, you prove it. We are finding documents that are proving that the government have been lying and they're covering everything up.
The government says there's no link between the tests and ill health and says individual medical records have always been accessible. Steve Peirce's late father was present at tests and he was later born with disabilities. He's been denied access to his father's blood tests and wants to know if radiation caused genetic damage passed to him in the womb.
We know he was exposed to radiation, and I have obvious disabilities. What was he exposed to? Because my condition is actually undiagnosed. Having access to these medical records and blood samples might help us determine whether that is the case.
From today, the campaign group aims to sign up as many as 1,500 surviving veterans for the planned court case. The Ministry of Defence said it couldn't comment on potential legal action.
Dominic Cassiani. Now, many journalists around the world have to work in dangerous conflict zones, very far away from the comfort of the kind of studio I'm sitting in right now. But here in London, the Frontline Club was formed 20 years ago on Wednesday to support such reporters and camera operators who work under life-threatening conditions. The founder of that club, Vaughan Smith, has warned that it is now more dangerous than ever to be a journalist working in areas like that. And he's urged news organisations to do more to protect the foreign journalists on the ground who assist their reporters. James Kumarasamy had a look around the Frontline Club.
The room you're in at the moment is the club room. Kind of got a particular look and feel, I think. The walls are covered in wood, which was the original flooring, which
you
I know, quite
I've been
like.
Here quite a few times. I've never
it did not
twigged.
Yeah, well, it was us trying to sort of save money. And actually, the pine walls look quite interesting, and it sort of gives a hint of something I saw out in the Balkans. We were really started, our community, our original community was from the Balkans.
The revolt of Bosnia's Serbs became a full-scale siege of Sarajevo. Sites which Europe had not seen for nearly 50 years were only the most visible evidence of ethnic cleansing.
You don't really get war stories because there's always someone who's got a better one. Also, at the same time when we started, that we became much more aware of the post-traumatic stress disorder problems that journalists were often having. And it's clear that one of the things you can do about that is engage socially with people who've had a rough time. It was a very healthy thing to be with the people who have done similar things to help you ease back.
There are memorials here, and I see a memorial here to Rory.
Rory Peck, a British journalist who was killed in Moscow covering the October coup in 1993.
Rory Peck was one of the original four. You know, half of the people who joined the agency were killed in the course of their work, and it was tragic, and it got a little bit too much for me to bear. And I opened the Frontline Club, really because I felt that as freelancers we'd made quite a contribution, but we hadn't really fitted into the industry and weren't always treated as well as perhaps we should have been. And so this is the memorial to the eight who were killed. It's very important to me that they're still here beside the bar. That's very much the origin of the club, because I felt I had a huge responsibility because we were all in it together.
Who were the most sort of interesting people that have stayed here?
We did have somebody who was extremely controversial called Julian Assange come and stay here.
His bail conditions require him to live here at this house in Suffolk. It's the home of Mr. Assange's friend and supporter, Vaughan Smith, a journalist who founded London's Frontline Club.
That was very challenging for us all. Half the club thought that it was really good, and the other half didn't. And we reconciled it, I think, in the way that journalists can do these things. We all got together in a room and listened to each other. Sometimes we look back at the way we treat people in history and we regret it. And I feel Julian is a case, and I think future people will feel that we mistreated him.
From your vantage point, how do you think the journalist's experience of conflict has changed over the 20 years the club has been here?
I think it's barely recognisable. It's become more dangerous, undoubtedly, because you only have to look. If you go to Bayeux in northern France, they have a memorial for journalists who've been killed. Every year they carve these names in stone, and there are more every year.
Vaughan Smith, who founded the Frontline Club here in London. Now, let's end on names. We don't choose our names. We have our parents to thank for that. I'm happy, mostly with mine. But is that going to be the case for the baby in Australia, whose parents decided to test their country's bureaucrats to its limits by registering their son as Methamphetamine Rules? Yes, you heard that correctly. Methamphetamine Rules. Kirsten Drysdale is a journalist, and she and her husband wanted to find out where the New South Wales Register Office would draw the line with their third child, who was born in July. It turns out meth is OK. The name was legally recorded. Tim Franks has been finding out from the baby's mum.
My jaw hit the floor when I saw the birth certificate. The registry have acknowledged that this shouldn't have happened, and they're going to work through processing a correction for us. So fortunately, there is no lasting harm done to my beautiful baby boy.
The name that is registered initially will sort of remain in perpetuity in some form. Is that not the case?
There will be an internal record that this has happened, obviously, within the registry, but he will have his own birth certificate with his real name on it, and this will not appear on that.
Okay. When are you going to tell him?
Well, we'll see how that goes. Well, obviously, we will tell him. Whether we hold off until his 21st birthday and present him with the the missing, the bad birth certificate then, or if he finds out earlier. We'll just see how it goes.
Assuming
but he will
that
know.
Assuming that none of his friends tell him, or that he has access to the internet, for example. Take me back to the moment when you came up with a name. I mean, it's a striking name, Methamphetamine Rules. Why that one in particular?
Honestly, because we just thought it's so outrageous that there's no possibility it will get through. And yet here we are.
Well, you know, I'm sure that you've done a public service by suggesting to the New South Wales Registry Office that they need to tighten up their procedures. Have you come up with a new name?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, he's got the name we call him. We're not going public with that name because we're just trying not to have it appear too much in conjunction with this one.
Yeah.
I think with the passage of time, I know the internet is around forever, but I'm sure there will be an outrageous story to take this one's place by next week.
Yeah. And what sort of a baby is he? Clearly, he's not anything like a methamphetamine addict at the age of 8 weeks. But is he? I mean, tell me what he's like.
He's actually the most delightful, beautiful, easiest, most relaxed little baby. He's a happy little chap. He's started smiling in the last couple of weeks. He's my third child, and I have my eldest is 5 and the next one's 3. So the fact that we've been blessed with such a chilled little guy, we're feeling very lucky about.
Well, that is wonderful. But my goodness me, what a start. I mean, not just to his life, but also to, I mean, you're an experienced parent now, but still 8 weeks old, and you're dealing not just with him, but also with a sort of international news sensation. I mean, it's quite a lot for you to cope with.
The last 24 hours has been crazy. I did a show a couple of years ago, and this was exactly the kind of media incident that we would unpack and analyse with the people at the centre of it. It's kind of been interesting for me to be on the other side of that. It was like watching a fire start.
Kirsten Drysdale, mum of Meth in New South Wales. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. Now, this edition was mixed by Chris Sablacqua. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.